Welcome to another fantastic episode of your most favorite podcast in the entire world, the Microsoft Cloud Show. No, I'm kidding. This is Techsplaining. And I'm here with Rob and Stephanie. And today we have a very special guest, the person who is responsible for everything I've ever done in the SharePoint world, Eric Schops, the SharePoint cowboy.
How you doing, Eric? I refuse to accept responsibility for Rackley.
This is your fault.
Yeah,
this
is your fault. Kind of my fault.
But it's not his fault. It's 100% his fault.
No. Only getting you started. If I'd have known the monster I was creating, I would have ran the other direction.
No. So the people who don't know this story, I've told it several times. I don't know if I've told it on the podcast. Really quick intro. This is a really quick intro to Shep, so then he can start talking. So when I started SharePoint back in 2007, I started off like most people and I hated it. I thought it was the worst thing in the world. I thought nobody actually knew anything about it and, you know, complained about it every day. So very similar to my job now.
But, yeah, I was like, and it's changed now?
What's
new? So I ended up finding a conference that was taking place in Tulsa. It was called
Tulsa Tech Fest,
yeah. And I thought, ooh, there's a SharePoint track. People know about SharePoint. So I went to this conference and I attended one of Eric's sessions and we talked afterwards. And he encouraged me to start blogging and get involved in the community. So without his encouragement, I would
not. Sorry, everyone. Sorry.
Thanks, Eric.
I know. See, what you try and do good, no good deed goes unpunished, right?
Yeah. True story. So, Eric, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about you for those who may not know who you are. And
For those who don't know, I've been around this game way, way, way too long. I think I've been an MVP since 2007. Isn't that the same as you, Rob? Didn't you come in the 07 wave?
Yeah. Yeah, I came in April, and you came in...
October.
Yeah.
So what do you guys do with all the extra pucks for your MVP award? Like, you get the little pucks every year? Like, are you guys out of space?
I am, actually.
They're teetering on the edge.
Yeah, I think next year, should we get renewed, we'll get a 15-year puck, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy. Yeah, so I think what we're actually technically supposed to do is take out the individual pucks and then just have the blue one to represent, but that's way more effort. It's easier just to throw one on top and carry on. Although I understand the cool new thing to do is to line them up across the top.
Ah.
That's what the cool kids are doing.
I'll never find out, so...
So yeah, I've been around this game a long time, all phases of SharePoint. And then of course, like everyone else recently, I've moved more to the cloud and Office 365, been doing a lot of Azure stuff, and now onto the whole Power Platform bits as well. So kind of seen and done it all over the years. Still mostly a developer, do some architecture type stuff still and whatnot, but I've tried to as much as I can.
You know, Mark started a vicious rumor about you a couple weeks ago. We were talking about you kind of in a private chat, and I just want to confirm that it's true or not, that you are a Dodge Ram man now. Can you hear me?
That broke up a little bit. I heard Dodge Ram.
Yeah, do you have a Dodge Ram now?
I do.
What
yeah.
in the
I've
world?
Had for years. Yeah, man.
He's had them for years.
Before moved up to a 2500.
I thought you were a Chevy guy with the Chevrolet sticker on your laptop. And, you know, I pay attention. The Texas.
I had a Chevy for a while. Yeah. I actually, one of my favorite trucks was a Chevy I had that had that quadrasteer, which were the back wheels turned.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool rig, but unfortunately it didn't last very long. It was prone to breaking down a lot. So from there I moved on to
Shocker.
Dodge. Haven't looked back. Yeah, surprising.
That's awesome. I'm sure you got a
cool
big lift
piece of
on it.
Technology.
You got a lift on it?
On mine, yeah, I've only got a 3-inch lift on mine, but I've got 37s on it, so it gets it up in the air a little bit. But I got to tow stuff, so I can't go with a 7-inch lift. Be nice, but it's too unstable when you're towing, man.
Well, man, so how did you end up? Because I know you're doing a lot of Power Platform stuff now, and you know I've always. You know, I've been around you for 15, 16 years now, and you've always been a hardcore dev guy. And now you're moving over into, I'm sure you're still doing hardcore dev stuff as well. But I mean, what was that transition you made to move into the Power Platform? What was the light bulb that says, you know what, that's where I need to focus?
Well, it we didn't do it on purpose like anything else. We've been doing Azure stuff for the last few years. Most of the projects we've worked on in the last few years have been Azure web apps with Microsoft Graph and tying back into the overall ecosystem. So we haven't done pure SharePoint development, and I can't tell you how long. It's been a long time. In fact, I think I can honestly say I don't think I've done any production SPFX apps. It's all been, you know, demos and cool stuff just to play around with the platform. But from the Azure work and working more on that side, we expanded beyond the SharePoint platform, getting exposed to lots of other stuff. And we started working a ton with Azure Functions and the things you would do over on that platform, Azure Web Apps and whatnot. And it just serendipitous, we got exposed to some customers who were working with and trying to adopt the Power Platform, specifically around Power Apps and Flow. And because we do a lot of workflow stuff, we're an in-text partner, and we've classically done a lot of workflow work, they came to us looking for some input. And watching them struggle, these are Power users, just your average person in the HR department or accounting or whatnot. Watching them struggle, try and build a flow or try and build a Power App, is just like fingernails on the chalkboard. And it's not that the tools haven't matured, because they have. It's that what we perceive as being easy, go in and create a formula and write an expression and use the syntax and do all the cool advanced stuff that the platform can do, to the average user, that's code. If you have to get in to where you're figuring out whether you need a single quote or a double quote and how to refer, oh, that goes in square brackets, not curly brackets, right? All that stuff, that's code to them, right? That's development. And they were struggling with adoption and moving these things forward because they couldn't get beyond the basic stuff out of the box. And that's when we kind of had the light bulb moment and said, hang on a minute, there's an opportunity here. We can make this so much easier for users and increase adoption by just repackaging that stuff into drag and drop components. That they can just configure, right, put their stuff in and go, and they don't have to worry about knowing all that other stuff. And that led to the genesis of creating a product and creating all the API infrastructure behind the scenes for it. And we're out now on the Power Platform, we're out on the Nintex platform, and coming soon, hopefully by the end of the year, we'll also be on Salesforce.
Nice. Now, could you be on ServiceNow by the end of the year too? We have some opportunity for you there.
I have no idea. It's interesting that a lot of the platforms that are out there now have open API extensibility. So when this, we were focused on Power Tools and our Power Platform and Nintex. And then we started to see, hey, Appian, which is, we don't come across that a lot in our work that we do, but it's used a lot out in the business. They have an open API spec. Y'all are probably familiar with K2, who plays a lot in the SharePoint space. They have an open API connector. So it's becoming the standardized way of connecting to external services. There's even a nice little jingoistic term for it now called the API economy, that people are starting to plug all of these applications together via these APIs rather than building bespoke custom components. So really, any platform that can connect to an open API RESTful service, we can run on that platform.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a really, I don't want to understate that's a radical shift into where we are today, right? Because before, you had to build all this infrastructure in. And now what we're seeing is that pluggable, okay, you want to integrate with these systems, you just plug them in, right? There's no, okay, I got to go learn the Salesforce API or whatever. You just plug this stuff in. I mean, they've got specific calls and stuff, but it's the way you integrate is a very standard way of plugging things together.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey, actually. In some cases, Microsoft is way ahead of that. I give credit where credit's due to Jeremy Thake and his team. Microsoft Graph is really leading the way in these enterprise extensibility stories. They're so far ahead of what other people are doing. It surprises me how much of the market Salesforce owns. First, take on them for a minute, and how immature they are when it comes to these type of interoperability. Like, they just released the capability to dev. I mean, within the last couple of years, the ability to dev in a similar fashion that we've been doing in SPFX for years, right? They were very late to that. game. Their connector process isn't nearly as mature as Microsoft. And so it's coming from this world into that world. You kind of look at it and go, man, how do you guys get along every day in this environment? But on the other hand, they do a lot of things in their stack that I wish we had in the SharePoint stack, with their native ability to deploy objects that go into their data structures and all that kind of stuff. But what's been as interesting as seeing that is seeing what's growing up around it. Because when we started this, we were going to go all Azure. We couldn't because their API management framework isn't mature enough yet. So we started looking out for other vendors. And some really big players have started to build entire business practices around API connectivity. We ended up going with IBM as our choice for the front end, but there's other people on the back end that are doing huge business, doing nothing but this. If you think about it, providing nothing but access to RESTful APIs, right? Monetizing that and securing it. And that's become a whole business that they're a managed service provider. And so it definitely opened our eyes as to some of the other stuff that's out there.
So when you build these custom connectors, this is something I've not played with at all yet. I mean, like, what's involved with creating a custom connector, and what's involved with like licensing to like be able to deploy that? I mean, what are some of the things going on there?
Thankfully for us, Microsoft has made it really, really easy. And big props to the Power Platform team. And especially, I think this was driven by the Power Apps and Flow folks initially. They've done a really good job of making it simple to integrate this stuff into your overall tenant and the 365 ecosystem, specifically around Power Platform. It begins with building an API. So wherever you host that API, we, you know, obviously like it if people did Azure Functions to build their APIs, but it can be any RESTful service that you build anywhere running on any platform. And then you need a definition that describes how you secure that endpoint, what the inputs and outputs are for each of your endpoints, and how you expose that to the user. So if you think of something simple like, we have a currency converter that will do real-time currency conversion between, I think we have 20 or 5 or so different currencies that you can convert to in real time that uses. And here's to Rob's point where it gets really interesting, because we're actually using guys on the back end to service our API that we're exposing. So it's you really are putting the Legos together and seeing who already has something that you can plug in. But in that, you want to describe your source currency, your target currency, right? If you want, you can get fancy and say, I want it from this exchange or that exchange or delayed quotes or real-time quotes or whatever. There's a lot of stuff you can do with that. So you need to define, the user needs to give me these values in this format, and this is the output that I give them back. And that's done in something called an open API specification, which is a JSON or YAML file that follows a pre-described format. Most people know it as Swagger. That's the Open API 2 version. The newer version is Open API 3. And you take this definition file, and Power Apps has a wizard that when you go to your custom connectors and do create custom connector, either in Power Apps or Flow, you can walk through the wizard and just step through it if you want. It will build a Swagger spec for you on the back end, or you could just drop wipe to the Swagger editor and just import your Swagger right in there. And when you do that, it automatically builds a little test harness for you so you can test it out. And all you have to do is plug in, I want this logo, I want this color for my logo, I want this description on it. And you can even click a button and it will deploy it immediately into your tenant from there. So they made it really super simple. It's a fantastic setup. Getting going with these custom connectors is probably easier on Power Platform than any of the other ones that we've worked with.
Now, if I wanted to go create one today, do I need additional licensing to pay for it? Or is that, it's just go create a custom connector and go?
Go. I don't know if you need to have a premium license or not for custom connectors. I'm not sure. I don't think so to do custom ones. I could be wrong on that. The licensing people probably jump all over us and tell us, no, you're wrong. You got to do this and that and this and that. But it's as easy as just going to custom connector, creating a new one, and literally walking through the wizard and saying, here's my URL endpoint, here's the parameter I want to provide, here's the output, deploy.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to check that out for sure.
Yeah, I've got a lot of great ideas for custom connectors we could need at my company. That's a great idea.
And that's the thing about like all the stuff coming out now in the Power Platform, in Azure, in Office 365 in general, is that you hear about something and it's like, oh, I don't even know how to get started with that. But when you dig a little bit, you find out it's really super easy to get started. I mean, like when I first started hearing about Logic Apps, I'm like, I don't know how to create a Logic App, but you know, you take 2 minutes to jump in there and create one. It's like, oh, well, this is a no-brainer. There's nothing to it. So I don't know. I think it's just cool how a lot of stuff's easy to get into.
It is, and the documentation teams, again, to give some good credit, I'm throwing around a lot of kudos here where usually I'm complaining, but they actually have done all the groundwork to get proper working samples and documentation for you so you know what to do. I was really impressed. So if you want to take your connector and then you want to put it into the gallery, so they don't have a store for Power Platform like we do in Office 365 or Azure. They don't really have a marketplace, but they have a gallery. And so you can publish your connector to that gallery, and there's an approval process that you have to go through. And it requires downloading this little command line utility that you have to run to package everything up and whatnot. And then you end up submitting stuff into a GitHub repo and whatnot. But the usually those are the parts of the process that are very poorly documented. I mean, think about Office 365 apps, right? Or SharePoint apps when they came out. I mean, there's no documentation, but it was hard to tell how to do this stuff. It was a big black box that stuff got poured into. In this case, it was actually really straightforward. You go, there's something called ISV Studio in Power Apps that you go into, you submit your package, they communicate with you through all the steps, and if they need something changed, they'll get back to you in a day or so. And it was actually a very pleasant experience to get that through the process and very well documented.
Good to know.
You know, that's another thing Microsoft, I feel, has changed their game on too, is the amount of documentation they have out there for us to be able to pick up this stuff very quickly and learn. I feel like the documentation is often done well before the feature or whatever I'm trying to do is released. And, you know, if I'm doing something wrong, chances are likely it's not that it's not documented. It's chances are likely I haven't read the actual documentation yet.
Yeah, I think we've seen that, haven't we, over the last few years, that not only are they more willing to engage with us early in the process and get feedback, I think that early engagement is starting to show dividends in when they do release something, they've already got it at least mostly documented, right? And a minimum partly documented. They've already got samples, right? They've already had a vendor go build some basic thing for them so that they, unlike the old days, they would announce a feature and then we wouldn't get documentation for a year or two or ever on that. So they really have changed that around, and it's impressive to see the pace that they're moving at on some of these newer things.
Something else I've noticed is that they've been taking down documentation that's out of date, because I think once we all shifted into SharePoint Online, you didn't have this definitive like year. You could say, well, this was SharePoint 2013 documentation or 2016. And we went a while where everything just kind of blended together and you were like, is this even real anymore? Is this available? You know, you're running into that kind of thing all the time. I feel like I've run into, and occasionally it means that there's a broken link, but at least incorrect information is no longer posted if something's been referenced. So I do feel like there's been a better push to get some of that old stuff down too, which has been helpful.
That's a really good point, because one of the most frustrating things on the Azure side is that they put things out there and then they just leave them. And so if you want to know how to go do something, you have to wade through, is this V1, is this V2, was this beta, right? What am I trying to do here? I understand their approach, right? Rapid, throw it against the wall, see what sticks, move on. But they don't do as good a job on that side about deprecating that stuff and moving it over to new stuff. So I agree with you that some of the other teams are doing a really good job of at least marking things as out of date or deprecated, so we know what it is we're looking at.
Yeah.
Gosh, we need more complaining.
Right? This isn't a typical shop session. He's not bellyaching about it.
Right.
Oh, it's been a fun process, I have to say. We went from concept to deployment in less than a year. including, so we have 60 something actions in our platform now. And so that includes all the dev and build and test and setting up a multi-vendor cloud network. Oh, that's a fun. You guys probably deal with that a lot, Rob, I would imagine, different vendors' clouds. You can't get anything to work with each other, and everybody does it differently. And
yep.
There's just, oh, man, that's been a severe challenge. That's been months just trying to sort out and learning how, like, I will pick on IBM a little bit here because they have a really good cloud offering that's outside of the Microsoft space, but they're so stuck in the 1980s service mentality that everything is open a ticket, send an email, wait a week for someone to get back to you, right? You know, get your invoice by paper email and pay by a check, right? Just if you want to buy something, you have to contact a sales rep and wait for them to get back to you. I just want to jump back into Azure and go, oh, look how easy this is. Just I can click here and make it happen.
So why did you decide to go with IBM and not Azure?
Their API management stack is much more mature. They're on their at least third rev, if not fourth rev of it right now. But the killer feature for us was monetization. Very few of the API management vendors give you integrated monetization. What I mean by that is the ability to do billing of customers natively in the platform. Microsoft, just like others, several others in fact, just gives you sample code and says, go do it yourself, right? And they have this awful developer portal thing based on paper bits that I've never even heard of, that I understand as some ex-Microsoft people, that for what it's designed to do, building websites and stuff, is actually pretty nifty. It's all Node.js based and whatnot. But in the terms of being a developer portal, it doesn't come anywhere close to fitting the bill. So we couldn't monetize it on APIM, and we couldn't do a proper developer portal on APIM. I love APIM. It's that's Azure API Management. It's a great first effort, really moving in the right direction there. It's so good that you can one click from Azure APIM, if you define your APIs, you can one click deploy to your Power Platform tenants from Azure, which is super cool. And the interface is really, really nice, but it's not mature enough, and it couldn't do the customer facing stuff we needed. So we ended up having to go with another vendor, and IBM had the most mature offering.
Okay. Makes sense. So what about licensing? How do you license your tools?
So everybody does that a little bit differently. Most API vendors do consumption-based licensing. So you have an API key, you're using an OAuth connection, and based on how many calls you make, that determines what level you're at. We do it the same way. So we have tiers of consumption based on how much you're using. A lot of API vendors offer a free tier. We do the same thing. In fact, Power Platform is the only platform we offer a fully free component. So the one we have in the gallery right now is 100% free, always will be. And we cap it, obviously, 50 actions a day, but that's still 1,500 actions a month you get for free with that. And a lot of that sort of freemium model or free upsell model seems to be pretty consistent across the API sphere right now. That's pretty much how everyone is doing it. Some break it down by this set of APIs connects to this and we'll charge you this much for that, or, you know, there's different ways to play with that. But for the most part, it's consumption based.
Okay. Cool.
What is the I guess when you start adopting this stuff, I mean, what is the way you guys are recommending that you, I guess, how are you pushing your documentation out? Because, you know, when I push a Microsoft tool out, I can go to the Microsoft Connector documentation and it's right there. So how are you guys kind of mimicking that model, or are you mimicking that model for this? Because, I mean, I think about, let's just say I want to buy your Nintex connectors, right? There's all kinds of things that we would have to go through over and above what we would a Microsoft generated, you know, the Outlook 365 connector or whatever, right? You know, there's things that we've got to go through at least for checks to say, is this safe? Where's the data being transferred from, stored, blah, blah, blah. What are you guys doing on that front to where that makes my job on that side a lot easier when I go to our risk folks and say, hey, we want to buy these connectors. Here's the risk. Here's where it's all documented. Go knock yourself out kind of thing.
Yes. So most of the API platforms have online documentation, interactive documentation, and most of them also provide a test bench and code generator, which is another reason that we chose the route that we did, because it was all integrated in one. So when you go to our customer portal and you go look at our APIs, you can drop right into the API spec. You can see all of the input output parameters. You can test it live right there. You can generate code for C Sharp or Node or whatever you want to do right through the portal. Some people host it in services like Swagger.io is the most popular one from Smart Bear. So people will put all their documentation up on Swagger so you can go see all that stuff. To your point, what people tend not to do, and we're no different, is expose where gateways and backends are hosted for obvious reasons that they don't just publicize that. But in order, for example, to pass the Salesforce security review, we have to give them all kinds of information about that so that they can commit to you as a customer, right, if you're using this. Microsoft didn't ask us to do that. Interestingly enough, I suppose that's because they're not actually brokering a transaction. It's just a gallery, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a roll it yourself. But it's certainly incumbent upon the customer to ask those questions. And we have a technical spec document that we provide. If you request it, we'll tell you where everything's at and how it's hosted and how it works. It's just not something we have publicly. Yeah.
Well, and I guess the majority of the data itself is going to be in whatever you're connecting to, right? So if you're connecting to Salesforce, it's going to be in Salesforce on your side. So whatever you're doing is just connecting to that. So I guess that's probably a thing, but I guess if your web service runs, say my Salesforce instance runs in Europe and your web services run in, say, Western US or whatever, mm-hmm. That means there's some transaction going over the pond. Some data flow could flow through the US, right? Which is, once you get into GDPR and all that stuff, it gets squirrely, right? It gets crazy.
That is exactly where it gets tricky. In our case, we're immune to all that because we don't actually store any data. So we just process transactions and return results. Everything is transient, so nothing is stored. Even in our logging, we don't store any very reason that you just brought up, because I don't want to get into a situation where I'm having to answer to some German court, right, about data that was stored resident servers in Dallas. But that's definitely an issue that folks have to be aware of. If you're rolling this kind of service, and it's either on platform, Salesforce being a good example, because there's so much sensitive data in a Salesforce instance. And there, I got to tell you, their security review process is exhaustive. They put you through the ringer on their side. But let's say that you just have this great idea to do this thing, but it requires that you store data in a SQL database somewhere, right, for a customer. You're going to have to deal with those questions, right? Where are you front-ending this from? How are you going to ensure that customers in the EU maintain their data in the EU? Do you have the infrastructure set up for that? It seems simple from the outside looking in, but building the infrastructure to meet those requirements is not only time-consuming, but expensive.
And hard. It's not always intuitive, right? Because you've got to set things up a certain way and, you know, make sure. I mean, it's crazy. I understand. I live that every day. And I'm convinced our cybersecurity guys would not launch email today, given the same standards. So what do you mean you can send an email to anybody in the world and it have it say anything? Too much risk.
Yeah, I think you're right. But it, credit to the cloud, at least the bigger cloud vendors like Microsoft and Amazon and IBM and some of the others, that they've given this some thought. So in Azure, for example, we can set up our geographic zones when we deploy our services, right, to say, I want to have this APM instance here and this APM instance here. And then I can use things like Azure Front Door to direct that traffic to where I want it to go based on input parameters like IP geolocation and things of that
And you know what's crazy about that is I think back 15 years ago, had we tried to do exactly the same thing 15 years ago, it would dang near be impossible.
Would have been right? impossible.
You would have to go to those countries and buy data space, you know, a data center space, set up servers, maintain all that stuff, hire staff to support it. It would be impossible to do. And right now, I can do it from right where I'm sitting at any time of day and deploy stuff most places in the world. It's amazing.
It's crazy. I actually used to do that. So I remember working on some projects where we were putting up Cisco global directors across the globe, right? With infrastructure stacks behind them and data centers. And the only point of having those was so we could localize that traffic coming out of those zones. And this was before all the data protection regulations, right? But you couldn't backhaul that kind of traffic across the Atlantic the way we do now without thinking about it, right? The pipes were skinnier then. So you had to make sure if a user was coming from the UK that they were going to a data center in the UK. So you had to go there. I remember flying to these places and walking into data centers and setting up these stacks of routers and switches and all this stuff to make these things happen. It was millions of dollars of infrastructure investment. And now we do, you know, next finish, and it's done.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's really, I wonder what somebody, if you were to take somebody from like the 60s or 70s where they were doing these big mainframes that maybe aren't around anymore and showed them this, it's just unbelievable to think about how far it's come in just such a short amount of time, right?
It is.
Well, and you know, I wasn't a big fan of the,
but benefits us, right?
Yeah, and I wasn't a big fan of the SharePoint global multi-geo stuff. But I have to say that stuff even works well. We had some hiccups early. Don't want to say we didn't, but man, it's really solid right now. I didn't think it would work, but it really works well.
And a lot of that credit goes to the Azure team for setting up the infrastructure to make that stuff work. And I don't know how many people they have cranking code out on that side. It's got to be a gazillion. people that, because they seem to roll this stuff so fast and change it. And every time I've gained a new appreciation for how good the Azure team is at releasing stuff by dealing with some of these other vendors that aren't quite so nimble in getting things shipped or whose UIs are still from, you know, 5 years ago. Whereas, okay, so you break a few eggs making the omelet, as the saying goes, right? Not everything that the Azure team ships works great and integrates. And, you know, there's some hiccups along the way, but I got to give them a lot of credit for how quickly they can get stuff out these days. It's amazing how fast they ship that stuff. It's amazing to me. So one of our endpoints is text-to-speech that we use cognitive services for on the back end, right? And I was shocked how much that has changed. 2 years ago, that was a really basic interface, right? You could do very few things with it. Now, it not only can you do stuff on the fly very quickly with a few REST operations, but it's so advanced now that you can do sort of this deep AI stuff. They have a whole nother tier that's deep AI that is scary good. How the audio that you get back with those things, it's impressive.
I'll have to check that out. Did you ever tell us the name of your product? I was trying to remember if you actually said the name of it, if people are trying to find it.
Not sure I did. It's Aptigent Power Tools. People can find it on aptigent.com, APPTIGENT.com. And our suite is called Power Tools. And so then go check it out. Give it a try. Cool. Grab the free version. If you find anything wrong, complain to Rackley.
That's fine. I'll deal with it.
Technical I'm support used to. MarkRackley.net.
Yeah, I'll deal with it. I can't say you'll get the right technical support, but.
So what have you guys been, this has been a weird time for the last few months, right? For all of us, I guess not as much for some of us who tend to work from anywhere. Right, I think Rob, when's the last time you saw an inside of the office even before all this went down?
I've been working, like my life changed zero when the pandemic hit. You know, it was like, everybody was freaking out. And I was like, what is happening? You know, but no, yeah. I mean, I guess for me, I mean, it's really been more of the same. I mean, we went from, I think about 70,000 people using Microsoft Teams at my company to over 400,000 in like 2 weeks. So it was like a hockey stick adoption. And we've actually maintained a fairly flat curve since about March 15th. So we're about 400,000 people, unique users per week on the platform. So it's been great for us. Like my little team, I mean, we weren't really big, right? But it was just the spotlight was like, oh my God, can they handle this? You know, give Microsoft all the credit on this. I mean, we didn't really see a hiccup. We saw a few hiccups where they were throttling some of the Azure API calls, the Graph API calls that we were calling into to do reports and stuff. But we just raised a ticket. And they're like, oh, yeah, we'll turn that back up for you. Sorry about that. But they did an amazing job on the back end for us. So we really saw no hiccups other than the mass adoption of people that we saw, you know, the number of teams being created and, you know, our reports getting bigger and all that. But it's been great.
Yeah. And, Stephanie, you know,
seen a lot of increase in your business regards to Teams?
Yeah. So right after everything happened with the quarantine, we had a huge spike in just training, you know, just that immediate rush of like, oh my gosh, we need to know how to do this kind of stuff. But what I'm curious about and what we kind of thought we'd see, which hasn't quite rebounded yet, is that second call of like, oh my gosh, we moved too fast and now we're a mess. Rob, I'm curious with you guys being so big, have you, like, how organized are they with that kind of rapid adoption? It's not really phased at that point. It's just like, let's go throw all the things in. Do you feel like there's any complaints over organization right now? Because we expected to hear that, but we're not really hearing that a whole lot now and then. But not in mass like we thought we would.
We were really lucky in that I feel that we almost overprepared. I mean, nobody knew this was going to happen, right? But the way we were rolling out the platform, we had all the governance processes in place, right? We had all of the, here's, you know, the training documentation and the how-to quick hit videos and a mechanism to set up if somebody wanted, hey, if you want to, you know, the consulting practice, if they wanted us to come in and do a 30-minute demo of here's the top 10 features of Teams or whatever, we had all of that collateral, that content developed to where we just basically shared it open out to the wild. And because we had a lot of prep work going in and the way we were rolling it out, it just accelerated that rollout for us, right? So, I mean, we didn't really see any craziness happen. So we had all of that stuff to communicate. Here's what you do. Here's what you don't do. Really, the biggest thing that we've seen is sometimes, and I don't know how they missed it, but it seems like I get a call or three or five every week. People love to go into SharePoint, like behind Teams, they love to click open in SharePoint, and then they start messing with those security contexts, right, in SharePoint, which breaks inheritance with the Office 365 group. That's been the biggest thing that we've had to deal with is people love, they go to Teams to do their team stuff, but then if they're doing file-based stuff, they go into SharePoint, and like if they share a file in a channel out from SharePoint, that breaks a lot of things in Teams or has the potential to break a lot of things in Teams. So we've been, you know, doing a lot of backwards training on just that one point, but it's been that's really been the only hiccup we've seen.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about governance in Teams and trying to stay on top of all that, this might be a great time to hear from one of our sponsors about just that sort of thing.
Now a quick word from our sponsor, ShareGate. Do you know how many files are shared outside of your organization? Are you sure that every team in your tenant has a valid owner? Well, ShareGate's got your back. After helping thousands of customers move to Office 365, they've learned that success in the cloud involves more than just migration. That's why they created ShareGate Apricot, an automated governance platform for Microsoft Teams and Microsoft 365 groups. ShareGate Apricot can help you answer questions like these without placing unnecessary restrictions on your users. With ShareGate Apricot, you can get full visibility across each team's lifecycle, from the time it's created all the way through the time it's archived. You can automate manual tasks involved in identifying problem areas like inactive or orphan teams. And you can collaborate with team owners on corrective measures to keep your teams tidy and secure. That's also why they've combined ShareGate Desktop, their trusted migration tool that you've probably all used before, with ShareGate Apricot in a single subscription, so that you can have everything you need to be successful in the Microsoft cloud. Now back to our podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you, ShareGate.
So, Stephanie, Rob, why do you think that is that you haven't seeing, because you're probably working with companies, it sounds like, who definitely were not as prepared as Rob's company was. Why do you think it hasn't come back around?
I wonder if it's the timing, if nobody's really kind of come up for air yet, you know, on we're still remote, we're still kind of in that COVID quarantine mindset. And I guess my thought is maybe we just haven't gotten there where we're just, we're good, we're managing, we're working from home. But you know, I could be wrong. Maybe it is that easy. Maybe they did get it rolled out and it's working. I guess part of me wonders if it's just going to take more time to come around, because right now nobody's changing jobs. You know, you're not, you don't have as many promotions. You don't have people leaving to go to other places. Nobody's hiring. So maybe there's not that shifting that normally happens. And something that we hear a lot with our customers is, well, I know where that is. And so I just tell everyone, or I tell them where it is, or I get it for them and share it. And I think the real challenge comes in is when you have people that need to access information, but they don't know where it's located. And maybe none of that shifting's happened because of the way the hiring is right now. So maybe that's part of it. But I'm not totally sure.
I say give it a little more time. I think that, you know, there's such a big capacity for creating teams now. Was it 2 million is the upper limit for creating site collections now? I think it's just going to take a little more time before they find out where that corner was they painted themselves into. So I still think it's going to come. I just think it may take a little bit longer.
Do you think part of it could be that people are just trying to get by at the moment, and they shelved all the things they would normally worry about, like governance, like oversight of the platform, and they're just saying, okay, let's just get through this time and we'll worry about all that stuff later?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it.
Maybe, and I think sometimes people don't worry about things until it's a problem. So, oops, somebody came in and had external access to something they shouldn't have had. Those kind of stories take time to come out, and that's really when you get motion on governance and security, is when there's a big oops. Well, I doubt they're all as proactive as your team, Rob.
Well, no, but I mean, the platform scales. Most mid-sized companies will never, ever, ever hit the upper bounds of what the limits are. You'll never have 2 million site collections, ever. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got 500 people, I mean, how many site collections can 500 people create over time before they just absolutely get tired of creating site collections? You know, so, I mean, I think that they might look around and go, whoa, we've got a lot of site collections. Maybe we should do something about that, but maybe not, right? Because they might not ever hit that upper bounds limit, and so what, right? I mean, so what if they do? There might be a legal. I think the legal aspect of it will get people before they hit any kind of limit, right? Of saying, okay, we've got content out here that's 10 years old now. What do we do about that? Do we need to delete that? Do we need to do something about that? And I think at that point, hopefully the tools will be more mature at that point 10 years from now. But I think at that point, they might actually look at going to do that. But until some legal thing happens, it may not even be an issue.
Or someone enables some feature that deletes all of your conversations. And, you know, it's when something disastrous happens that you weren't planning on, that's when you start looking at it and taking it seriously.
So one thing that I've noticed, I'm curious, because you all have way more exposure to day-to-day Office 365 clients than I do, but one thing I've noticed from dipping our toes into the Salesforce space is that every organization that has Salesforce has a Salesforce admin, right? Or one or more. Someone is responsible for owning that platform, even though it's a cloud service and always has been there. If you ask someone, who's your Salesforce admin, they'll answer you right now. Oh, it's so-and-so over here. But when I talk to clients and say, who's your Office 365 admin? Sometimes you just get blank. Oh, it's the security team, or I think the server guys run that, or maybe it's the SharePoint people. Do you feel that people are lacking the understanding that they need someone to manage this platform, that an admin is necessary for all of this stuff?
Well, so I know Stephanie's got some thoughts on this, so I want to jump in before she does. But I think one of the things we see is that a lot of Office 365 is very much siloed, because you start with Exchange. So you've got your Exchange admins, and then maybe you migrate SharePoint. So maybe you take your on-prem SharePoint admins and put them there. And they're usually different groups, and they usually butt heads about who owns what. And there's, so there's these silos get put up as you start rolling out Office 365.
And it's a turf war is really what ends up happening, is what I feel like. And it's getting better as they start to learn, but Teams really created a lot of confusion in that space, because Teams involves Exchange mailboxes, that involves SharePoint, which is like total opposite ends of the spectrum from an administration standpoint. You've got people who manage the business, you've got people who manage the SharePoint environment, you've got people who are managing really hardcore IT stuff like Azure. Well, it would have been, you know, on-premises AD and then Azure AD and Exchange, totally different mindsets, different approaches. And then when Teams kind of picked up, and now that it's running with like meetings and conferences, now you've got the telephony people involved. And everybody's kind of managing that same platform and wanting different things. And on top of all of that, that umbrella over everyone is the security team. And so the larger the organization, the more of that like infighting you have over who controls what and who's allowed to be a global admin. Mm-hmm. And what we've experienced is that the global admins tend to be your Exchange administrators, because they got in first. And that's the only reason. And nobody's really had that overall governance conversation on who really needs to be a global admin, which at one of our companies, I like how they handled it. It's no one. You have to ask for that elevated privilege, and you only get it for a certain period of time, and then it's taken away again. And then everybody else kind of does their own thing in their own areas, which makes a lot of sense to me. So I think it's really interesting, because it's hard to say you should have an admin, or for a small to medium business, what kind of skill set do you need? You're all over the board. It's really hard to do without some kind of additional backup support consultant, whatever. Lots of different spaces to cover.
Yeah, we have a, of course, my dad has a small business, and he's kind of that. There's really no admins. I guess I'm the admin slash guy, whatever. But no, for us, actually, our Exchange admins are Exchange admins. They have no access to anything else, right? Our SharePoint admins and Teams admins are the same team, but they have no access to anything else. Actually, our global admins, we have four on a company of our size, and that's two in the US, one in the UK, and I believe one in India, so that we can go round the clock. But it's our Active Directory administrators, right? It's the identity and management team, right? That are the global admins, because they're gods all over the over the place anyway. But they kind of manage the platform from a global admin standpoint, right? And but there's very few of them, whereas the Exchange team might have, you know, depending on the country, you might have three or four in the US, you might have two in England, you might have, you know, whatever, three in Canada. And then the SharePoint is more, a little more consolidated. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, from a small and medium sized business, I mean, does it, again, because of the things that people are doing, do you even need to know your admins or need one? I mean, because you're not going to hit any of the upper limits, I don't believe, anytime soon. About the only time you need an admin is when something's broken and you need to raise a ticket with Microsoft. That's about it. And how often does that happen in a small to medium business?
Well, I can't help but wonder if we're approaching an inflection point where managing your cloud platform is as important as managing your on-prem infrastructure was back in the day, right? Like, you wouldn't conceive of a medium to large SharePoint farm without a SharePoint admin, right? Someone that runs that. And with all the controls now, and as rapidly as things change in Office 365, is that position now shifting to say, I need a cloud admin who does all this stuff? Because if you think about wanting to do things like all the security and compliance pieces and everything, just doing something as simple as e-discovery in the organization means you have to cross Exchange, SharePoint, Teams, right? There's all these components, and there's so many dials and switches and whatnot. Does it A, create a position for those type of people, and B, does it create a consulting opportunity for consulting organizations to, whereas you would and still do, some of us still do to a certain degree, provide managed services around the SharePoint platform? Are you managing services for Office 365 for running that for small organizations like your dad's business, for example, who don't have those capabilities but need someone to fill that gap?
And it's a big gap because you've got so much changing so quickly. You've just, you know, to get your arms around everything that's available or the new security policies that you should have implemented, or, you know, the fact that we're still hearing about people that don't have multi-factor authentication enabled, you know, that's simple. That's a really easy way. Like, how do they not know about this stuff? But you've got to remember that a lot of these, especially medium, small companies, they've had the same, some of them have had the same person working in the same place for 20 years. They don't have exposure to other cloud technologies. They don't even know what to be looking for, much less to be able to deal with the constant amount of change and things that they should be dealing with on a day-to-day basis. So I think it's important, if you're not going to bring in a consultant, at least be engaged with others. Microsoft is a fantastic community. So it's one of those, you know, I know right now we can't go to user groups, but you know, join conferences online, virtual conferences, webinars, whatever you can do to get up to speed. Because being in your own silo in a small company, there's a lot that can be missed.
Yeah, my dad's response to that would be like, yeah, I'm not doing that.
Well, and the thing is, if you want to be one, an admin of your entire environment, you need that needs to be your only job. And that's just not the case for a lot of these small businesses. They've got multiple hats to wear, so they can never go deep enough to know everything that they need to know.
Well, are they, is there a need to do things like e-discovery in the smaller business? I mean, do you see that a lot, that they're actually using those tools, or that, are they using, hey, we're gonna store our documents in OneDrive, or we're gonna store our documents in Teams, and they kind of use the collaboration features and of course email, but really beyond that, you might have some Power Automate stuff that goes on or whatever, but are they using it to a deep enough level to where they are gonna go do, you know, they have to do legal holds. I mean, I would assume things like a law office might, but I mean, for your average customer, I mean, is that a thing? Do they even use those tools?
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of the mid-size companies, like especially like in the oil and gas space, they have legal departments, and so they do need to do legal holds. So it is a thing.
Well, what we've learned over the past few years is that it depends on who your customers are. Right.
That's,
like,
yes.
So we have to do business with DoD contractors, and because we do international business, there's a lot of requirements for us to do things that maybe your average small business wouldn't have to do. I mean, certainly the ice cream shop down at the corner that has five locations isn't dealing with the same insurance and compliance requirements that I have to deal with, you know, for some of our customers. I mean, the InfoSec documents we have to fill out is just insane. And I'm sure you guys have to deal with the same thing with bigger clients. So maybe it's not so much the size, maybe it's the vertical that you're in or the type of customers that you service, that having these tools, we used to have a really hard time responding to these security questionnaires, because it was all about, have you secured your firewalls and your servers and you're this and you're that and the other thing and all this stuff you had to answer. And now all we have to do is tick a box that says Microsoft Office 365.
But not all of them accept that yet, because we just went through this too. And it was an old school InfoSec security form. And I tried to tell them that, right? I was like, look, we've got all these tools. We're on E5. We have all this automated alerting set up, you know, all this stuff. And they're just like, they don't get it, because we are helping them make that transition to 365. So on our end of things, they're not educated on it yet. And it's almost like, you're educating them as they go. I actually have a rant out there ready to go for, I call it an educational RFP, but it's kind of the same thing. Because when they ask you for something and they're not actually educated to the point where they know what to ask for yet. So you kind of have to help them through that process of, here's what you should be asking for, because what you gave me isn't even enough for me to quote what you need. And it's kind of the same thing on the InfoSec side. They're giving you this questionnaire, but they don't even understand what you're giving back to them yet. So it's a really complicated place to be. We have a lot of questions, a lot of back and forth on this, because it's a hard place when you're working with customers that aren't up to speed yet on that. But we definitely deal with it. And I agree, customers make a big difference on how much you have to do and kind of what levers you need to be using in 365 to be compliant for those customers.
One of the questions that I struggled with for years is, would we have seen the type of O365 adoption that we have seen over the last few years without email? And in my mind, the answer is no. right? If we weren't outsourcing people's email, people wouldn't be signing up for this stuff, right? But today, with Teams and OneDrive and all the other services that come along, you know, Planner and all the stuff you get out of the box, Yammer and all that stuff, is that the same conversation? I'm not so sure. I think there's enough value in the platform outside of email that that conversation changes. But does it, for the average, to Rob's point, for the average user, do they know about that stuff and do they even care? Or is it just make my email problem go away?
I think because they made Exchange so flexible to where the migration story for Exchange going up to Office 365 it's an amazing story, right? If you have multi-country email boxes, right? So you got some email boxes in the US and Canada and the UK, whatever. Migrating that stuff around is just seamless. I mean, it just works. You can have some stuff in the cloud, some stuff on premises. Absolutely amazing stuff. Most migrations to Office 365 start with email, right? I think due to the success of email being so easy to try it out, to step into the cloud, and you realize that, okay, I don't have any data residency issues, I can solve all those problems, I think that did feed into the success of Office 365 overall as a platform, right? Because no way would we have gone to SharePoint Online had email not been such a success story for us, right? No way. If email was a disaster, there's not a chance we would have turned it on. Just a perspective.
Interesting. I wonder if we aren't starting to see that there's so many features in the platform now that remember the SharePoint 2013 sort of era where we were putting everything in the one box, right? And it almost got to be too much. There were too many services running on the platform. There was too much stuff just kind of cobbled together, right? How many farms have we seen where a SharePoint gets taken down by SSRS, right? I don't have fingers to count. Right. Those kind of things. Do you think we're seeing the same kind of things with Office 365 that we're plugging too much stuff into this platform or have we not reached that point?
We've well reached that point. Honestly, well, from my perspective, we reached it. We reached it about 2 years ago. And the problem we're seeing is that there's so much confusion about when to use what and where. Like, when do I use Teams versus Yammer versus Project versus Planner, you know, so there's all of these things that do similar things.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, and with the new stuff like Microsoft Lists, Project Oakdale, I mean, we're throwing even more things into the mix where it's another way to do another thing. And it's just, it requires a lot more education to get anything accomplished the right way. Yeah. I agree.
But were they doing those things anyway? Here's my argument on that. With the amount of shadow IT, they were going and collecting all of these applications on their own. The benefit to having them in one umbrella is the fact that you can control it and you have the security and the policies to go over all of those things that the business was going for anyway. So it is confusing, but at the same time, I feel like it was happening regardless of whatever Microsoft decided to do. So I do think there is benefit to having all of that control. Whereas before we had all this intellectual property sneaking out the door and all these different applications because they needed some slight variation. Like not everybody can use Project Online because it's too complicated. Not everybody can use Planner because it's not complicated enough, right? So to do is for personal stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of task applications and a lot of project management, quote unquote, applications available, but they each serve their own purpose. And there was a reason those were created. And it's because, you know, one by one, Microsoft's trying to, you know, take out the competitor that was popular and pull it in. So I guess I see both sides of that.
So what I think I'm hearing you say is that all of that stuff was there anyway. And therefore, it's better to bring it all under one umbrella and with more management controls than the way it was before, which is just kind of loosey-goosey all over the place.
Yep. I think they were gonna do it anyway, so you might as well at least be able to control it, give them something they can use. You don't have to use all of it, right? You don't have to use anything you don't want to.
It's just really
confusing. I know it makes lots of fun for you, Rob.
No, it's just really confusing. I mean, we do get a lot of questions on that, and I love the change, and I think we're all really fortunate that we don't have to wait 4 or 5 years for another version of SharePoint to come out. You know, it's constantly changing. But there's a downside of that too, is a lot of times I feel like, and our people feel like they're walking on quicksand, right? Because every step you take, there's something changing underneath your feet. And for us, it's been kind of a negative that we can't just set and be on the platform and let it just be the platform it is for a little while. But you know, tomorrow we might come in and things are drastically different. It's not a bad thing. It's just it's a cultural shift to life in the cloud, I guess is what I should say, right?
Keeping us all in business and employed.
It is.
It does do that.
Well, I know Mark had to drop here, so he's gone. So I guess that's our cue to wrap. So we've been going for about an hour anyway. But thanks everybody for joining and listening. You know, Eric, it's always great to catch up. We don't do it often enough, my friend. And you know, I hope everybody enjoyed the podcast today. If you have any questions or comments, please send us an email at info@techsplaining.net. And until next time, we will almost certainly be bringing you a show next week.